Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang gunutarang upacayang namasami. It's always surprised me how readily people who have never even considered the question of the nature of reality believe that they know what it is. So you will say, oh, you know, you can meditate and make your mind peaceful and be mindful and so on, but, you know, could you survive in the real world? You know, so as if they knew what the real world is. So from my point of view, you know, it's completely the other way around. I think, oh, you know, he or she can make lots of money and be successful in the crazy world around us, but I don't know whether they could survive in the real world, which is the world that you encounter when you sit down and close your eyes and have to be with yourself. One of the great European philosophers, the Frenchman Pascal, famously said that all of mankind's problems are because he's unable to be alone with himself in a room. And for all of those many people who can see absolutely no reason why a sane human being should choose to get up early in the morning and sit with their legs crossed and their eyes closed for hours a day and see no importance or value in spiritual cultivation. I've said, well, I challenge you to spend a day in a room alone without any devices and without any entertainments and without going to sleep. Can you do it? Very, very difficult. That's the real world, isn't it? I mean, that's much more real than tuning into a electronic device and being taken away by pixels on a screen. So one of the first things that we can observe about the Buddha's teachings is that the Buddha doesn't start off with big metaphysical statements about the nature of reality and the Godhead and all these kinds of mystical terms which are impossible to understand or verify. But the Buddha starts off with some basic statements about life as anyone can recognize. The Buddha is pointing to the fact that having been born, then we are subject to old age, sickness, death. that sooner or later we will be separated from everything and everyone we love. So these are very basic, kind of blunt statements of truths that no one can deny. But the Buddha is saying that peace can own and true liberation is possible in our lives only when we are willing to stop and look at the simple truths of life. They're very complex philosophical propositions about existence we can put to one side, but learn how to stop and to look. So one of the two of the main technical terms that meditators in this tradition are familiar with are samatha and vipassana, are usually translated as calm or tranquility and insight. And there has been a long debate about the relationship between these two states, and these two practices. But all I'd like to say on this topic right now is that a very simple way of looking at these two terms is to say that samatha means to stop and vipassana means to look. So the Buddha is teaching us to develop the skills to stop and to look. Great Zen master once divided people into two groups. He said, those who use time and those who are used by time. And in the modern day, the number of people who are used by time has greatly increased. And many people have made a trade-off and they've bought material wealth at the expense of time. So now people are time poor and materially wealthy. And the willingness and the interest in stopping and taking stock and looking at what's what is sorely lacking from our society these days. This is why it's so stressed out and so superficial. Because we've all had that experience of just suddenly stopping and saying, what am I doing? How did I get here? That's like a waking up, a small awakening in our lives. And when I was a school student, one of my favorite poets was an American, a contemporary of Jack Kerouac, called Gary Snyder. And he appears in Jack Kerouac's books under the name Jaffe Ryder. Anyway, Gary Snyder wrote a memorable poem about hitchhiking up the Pacific Highway and being picked up by a truck carrying alfalfa, some food for for horses. And he's chatting with the driver of this truck, and driver of the truck said, I started driving this truck up this road when I was 18 years old, and I made a vow to myself that I wouldn't spend the rest of my life doing this. And you know, that's exactly what I've gone and done. And I read this when I was like 16 or something, And he goes, it had a great effect on me. And I thought, whatever I do in my life, I don't want to be like this truck driver that suddenly realizes at the age of 40 or 50 that he's been doing exactly the thing that he thought he'd just be doing for a short period of time. And so that that willingness to stop and to look and to question, had this whole session talking earlier about the importance of questioning and choosing the right questions and the useful questions to ask, and then persevering with those questions even if it's difficult and uncomfortable. But meditation is one of the roles that it fulfills is it enables us to develop the tools to stop, and not just to stop to switch off, but to stop to switch on or to illuminate the nature of things. So the Buddha is telling us that in a study of humanity, the nature of human nature, then we are the very best guinea pig. And the laws and the patterns and the processes that we can identify within our own minds, these are common to all human beings. So they may differ in the details, but overall, it's the very same thing. So we could say that the kinds of stimuli that encourage feelings of greed in a city dweller in Bangkok in the 21st century would be somewhat different to those which stimulate the same feeling of greed 2,500 years ago in the countryside of northeastern India. But at the same time, we could say that whatever the particular stimulus might have been, it was, you know, in the realm of the senses, of the sound, form, sounds, odors, tastes, bodily sensations, thoughts, and so on. And when we stop, then, and we look, and we see things in a different way. So for the worldly mind, then, you know, the adventure and experience, you know, we can go to this country and that country and have this experience and that experience, and people become very envious of that kind of life. But if we look at it more closely, then no matter what country, what place in the world that you might go, no matter how exotic and marvelous, or even if you were to go in one of Mr. Musk's spacecraft and go to another planet even, all that you would ever be able to experience are forms visible to the eye, sounds audible to the ear, odors recognizable by the nose, tastes by the mouth, the tongue, physical sensations and mental states. So from seeing an incredibly wide and varied and rich field of experience, looked at it another way, it's really quite restricted and narrow. It's just that much. You know, when you see that whatever you can see, it's a form. It's just a form. It's just a sound. It's just an odor. So that doesn't take away the enjoyment of life and make, you know, the whole world of sensory experience this kind of featureless, boring kind of desert. But it gives a new context to it. It's like difference between, if I could give an analogy, the difference between the meditative awareness adds to life. It's like the third dimension. The worldly view is like two-dimensional art, if you like, and the experience brought about through training of the mind adds a third dimension, a depth and a perspective to experience. And we begin to have some kind of principle in prioritizing our goals in life. So often we see what can sometimes be huge differences, or even conflicts between people. When we look more closely, it's often not such a huge gulf as immediately appears. What I mean by that is that if Mr. A is pursuing this path and Mr. B is pursuing that path, and those paths are very different, they think, well, you know, they're in a completely different world of experience and values. But it may be that Mr. A actually respects the path of Mr. B, but if he had to make a choice between the two, he chooses the one that he's following. And similarly, the other person doesn't completely reject the other path. It's just that he's put it lower down on his list of priorities. And I think this is an important way of seeing beyond immediate conflicts of values. That because someone is not following the same path as you, it doesn't mean that they reject it altogether. It's just that they're not giving it the same importance. It's not central to their life. But usually this prioritization goes according to instinct or prejudice or just following the stream of what's happening around us. In meditation, we're starting to look more closely. So, meditation, we're giving the mind a job, giving the mind a task, which runs counter to the usual way we use our minds. And the initial value of doing so is that it illuminates the processes of the mind. It's to say that in a traditional analogy, it's as if we're just flowing along with the stream of our life. And if we're flowing along with the stream of our life, and we can't see the banks on either side of the stream, it's very difficult to gauge how fast we're moving, where we're going. But if you turn your vessel around and start to move against the stream, then you're immediately aware of the nature of that stream, how strong it is, and you get all kinds of new information that you would not have access to if you were merely laying back and following the stream. So the analogy is here giving the mind a simple object to focus upon is like going against the stream, and all the mental reactions to that effort are the information that arises about the nature of the stream. So many people, when they begin to meditate, say, you know, I've actually become less peaceful than before I meditated. And it can seem like that because formerly you weren't aware of just what a mess your mind was, how full of junk your mind is. But when you stop following it, go against it, it becomes painfully obvious. So the early stages of meditation, you know, are very much taken up with this exposing the nature of the mind, exposing the nature of defilement, understanding what that word defilement means, not as a concept, but as an experience, and learning basic life skills. I've spoken a few times already about this life skill of being able to put forth relaxed effort. Most of us know how to put forth effort. Got some work to do, grit your teeth, be disciplined, get on with it, get it done. And that's one useful skill. But it also brings with it a lot of stress and tension, and sense of self tends to become very strong. And then after we finish that burst of effort, then we usually feel like we deserve kind of reward or relaxation, and we go to the other extreme. So in meditation, we're trying to establish a new kind of paradigm, a new kind of way of approaching work, whatever kind of work it may be, not necessarily spiritual work, but one in which there are the best elements of effort and the best elements of relaxation combined. Now, when we try to be mindful of the breathing, then we have a very efficient feedback system, because if you put too much effort into attending to the breath, then the breath becomes unnatural, and you start to develop some constriction in your chest or headache, and it doesn't work. If you become too relaxed, then either the mind goes off into daydreams, or you get sleepy and dull, or even fall asleep. So here our goal is to be able to develop relaxed effort, and the breath is giving us immediate feedback as to how well we're doing. And when we have got that relaxed effort, we can't just assume that we've got this worked out now. Because of the special nature of the breath is not a stable, fixed object. The breath is changing, and the breath becomes more subtle as we pay more attention to it. And so that balance of effort and relaxation has to be constantly tweaked or calibrated or slightly adjusted. Otherwise, the object goes out of focus, and again, we drift into dullness or into one of the other mental defilements. But this is the particular challenge of the breath, in that the breath is changed by our attention to it, and we can't simply sort of tune in to the breath frequency and then go on to automatic pilot, because then we lose the mindfulness. So there has to be that alertness and wakefulness of mind, that interest in the object. And this is the skill and the art of meditation. Now, another famous 20th century quote: mankind cannot stand very much reality. And this is one of the oft repeated pieces of wisdom, But it, as in most Western sayings, it's based upon an idea of the human being as fixed and the unenlightened state as being the natural and inevitable state of the human mind. So with a lot of these phrases, the Buddhist says, yes, that's true for someone who's never trained their mind, but not for someone who has. So the unenlightened mind, the untrained mind, finds it very difficult to bear with reality for very long at all. It doesn't have the tools and the resources and the strength, fortitude to do that. But we can, through this practice of meditation, we're increasing our capacity to be with whatever may appear. But in the beginning, in meditation, we notice all the ways in which we have developed strategies and habits of turning away from reality. So for many people, when life and when experience becomes unpleasant, then sensual pleasure is the immediate refuge, whether it's sex or food or shopping or movies or entertainments or some kind of strong, pleasant, sensual rush to make us forget or allow us to forget our discomfort. And drugs of all kinds, alcohol, play an important part in this, of course. So this is the natural, instinctive response or reaction to suffering in our lives. And it's, as I say, it's one of those strategies which is so natural and so instinctive that very few people would even recognize it as a dukkha or a suffering avoidance strategy at all. It's promoted and is a very positive thing, you know, sort of a love of life. And when I used to go back to the West quite infrequently, every 2 or 3 years, one of the things I really like to do is go to bookshops, but I like to read the back pages, the blurbs and the praise that they give books, because it's like a snapshot of the value system of the culture, and you know what words they use to praise books. It changes over the course of time. So I noticed, for instance, after I'd been a few years and as a monk, and I go back, and in England, a word that would be used to praise a book is irreverent. You know, that's like a sort of a very positive term. You know, this is an irreverent look at something or other. And then disturbing became a very positive word for a while. You know, this is a very disturbing book. You know, like, buy it. You know, it's disturbing. So we have all these kind of weird ideas about, you know, what is attractive. But the one that I found really weird, the most weird, is life-affirming. This was a very big one. You know, this is a life-affirming book. Well, what does that mean? You know, why does life need affirming? I mean, it's you know, it's already here. You know, so yeah. It's only when you stop and you look and you think, what does it actually mean? You know, life affirming. It means that life is okay, or life is a good thing, or it's better than what? You know, so they say, okay, life affirming, life's better than death. Yeah, well, probably everyone would agree with that already. Anyway, something of a digression, but I think that when we see like life affirming, probably a Buddhist way of saying it's like samsara affirming, or basically that you know, the sensual world is a good thing, and passion is a good thing, and so we're returning to this idea of ditti and underlying views, and there are this kind of view that a life devoted to the senses is inevitably one of ups and downs. And the ups outnumber the downs, and because you have the downs, you have the ups. And so if you want the ups, you have to put up with the downs. And, you know, these kinds of ideas that underlie modern culture, you know, we need to stop and look at them and see whether or not, in fact, they make any sense. So, what's the Buddhist attitude to these things? Well, the Buddha recognized, you know, there are things which are pleasant and agreeable in the world. And if there wasn't, then nobody would become attached to them. But that these things should not become refuges, or should not become escapes or crutches or things that allow us to close our eyes to the true nature of things, because ultimately the true happiness and peace comes from understanding. And to understand something, you have to be willing to look at it, not just the aspects that are enjoyable, but the whole package, the whole thing. And so with the body, it was just saying, don't just look and become obsessed with the attractive elements of the body, but try to see the body as it is. So we look at the body, there are certain aspects that are immediately attractive and interesting, and there are other aspects of the body which produce no emotion at all, and there are other parts of the body which we find kind of disgusting. This is the body, is a complex thing. It has attractive, unattractive elements to it. But the Buddha's pointing out that we try to censor the unattractive elements and hold on to and focus exclusively on the attractive elements. And that's a distorted vision of the body. So we need to develop the ability to look more closely and develop a more comprehensive and a more mature understanding of the nature of our bodies and other bodies. So the meditation is this first like few steps into the water, if you like, of developing the ability to see things clearly. The value of samadhi, the Buddha said, and the reason why we develop this inner stability of mind is the stable, clear mind is capable of seeing things as they are. So the untrained mind is one of its weaknesses, is that there is an automatic, unconscious reaction to phenomena, both external and internal, which comprises of a movement towards and a grasping at phenomena, or a pushing them away. And that instinctive movement, grasping at and pushing away, is what prevents us from seeing things clearly. So the mind which has been stabilized by meditation is at least temporarily freed of that instinctive reaction and is able to see things clearly, to see what's what. Initially, as I say, we're we're observing what happens when we put the mind on the spot. So usually the mind gets bored because we're giving it a unexciting job. You know, look at the breath. This is not exciting in any way. So after a while, you get bored. Then what does the mind do? What does the mind do when it's not happy? It's not content? Where it feels uncomfortable? Does it go off and search for memories of the past? Does it go off into fantasy mode? Is it thinking? What does this mind like to think about when it's distracting, when it's looking for distraction? Because whatever it might be, whether it's sexual, sensual, whether it's thinking about music or movies or politics or sports or family or whatever, the common denominator is that we seek to think about something that gives us this kind of warm glow. You know, this is kind of just a pleasant feeling. And that's the hook. So when the mind wanders off, then we bring it back, one of the reasons this doesn't work so well is that we think we're bringing the mind back from this kind of thought or this kind of memory. And that's basically it. The mind is too interested in those things. That's not wrong. But what we also need to recognize, observe, is that pleasure that we're taking in the distraction. Because if there's still that satisfaction and that interest and that desire for that small pleasure of distraction, then the mind will go back for more. That's the addiction. It's not the addiction to the particular thought, the particular imagination. It's the feeling that it provides. So don't be simply aware of the content of the distraction, but also the tone of it and the pleasure that you're taking in it. So one of the key teachings the Buddha said is to realize the highest happiness, we have to be willing, courageous enough to let go of the small pleasures. So it's not that we don't need or we can do without pleasure or happiness in life, but it's this prioritization. Realize this level of pleasure that comes from distraction is very superficial and it doesn't go anywhere. It's just that much. But the joy and the bliss and the inner well-being that starts to develop from a mind that can let go of small pleasures is so marvelous. There's just no comparison at all. But you have to, you know, be willing to make that initial jump, you know, to say, well, yeah, I don't know what that's like, that inner bliss and happiness. And I'm afraid if I let go of this pleasure, yeah, maybe just a small pleasure for sure, but it's better than no pleasure at all. And this is the fear in the mind that we get caught in the middle ground, and not the middle way, but the middle ground. You've given up those things that give you some measure of contentment and pleasure in life, and yet haven't reached anything any better. So that's where you need the faith and the patience to push on. So for some people, the reaction and the tendency is to dwell in negativity. And the whole process, this whole impersonal process of negativity is revealed so clearly through meditation. So if it's it can be a strong memory of something somebody did or said that upset you in the past, and suddenly it's there in your mind and it's just completely all absorbing. But often it manifests as this petty kind of irritation. It might be irritation with yourself that you can't meditate in the way that you want it to. But often it's this fault-finding mind that is revealed, and you find yourself irrationally irritated by the way the person next to you gets up or sits down or moves or coughs or opens the door or closes the door. It's too hot, or it's too cold, or it's too stuffy, or it's too this, and this whole fault-finding machine suddenly cranks up, and because it's suddenly appeared because you're trying to focus on the breath or on an object, the whole the humor of it and the ridiculousness of it becomes very clear. It's just so obviously conditioned by your present activity. You see, usually when we get negative about people and situations, it always seems like we're being kind of smart and observant, doesn't it? And the cynic, always believes that he or she is smarter and more honest than everyone else. Yeah, they may be off in this kind of fantasy world, but I'm willing to see the harsh truth, that everybody is really just out for what they can get, and this. So, taking the darkest possible view of everything and then boasting that you're being more honest than everyone else. So when we get negative, when we can really feel that we're being smart. But this is what the value of when you meditate, you see, where's all this negativity come from? It's simply because I'm giving the mind a task and it finds it difficult and it's reacting to it. So we talked a little bit about sleepiness and dullness of mind, and how that can also be a way of escape. Often people have this very, they're very, the way that dullness manifests is that often the quality and intensity of mindfulness starts to taper away, just like if you're playing sport and towards the end of the game you start to get tired, make mistakes. Similarly in meditation, if you're not trained the mindfulness very well, as time goes on, it becomes harder and harder to maintain the mindfulness, and mistakes and distractions occur, and then dullness can set in. But there's also, some people, it's almost the moment they sit, very short period, they start to nod or to go into a blank and dark state. So there are some different reasons for this, but one is that it's an almost automatic switch mechanism. And when people are having to look at something which they find uncomfortable, or confronted with their own difficulties or vices, and then they just turn off the switch. And perhaps this is more, I can probably say more common with men than women, so I don't want to talk about it. It's like stone wall method of dealing with conflict. Shut up. And so men do this more than women, I think, generally. But this can occur in meditation. You just shut up, and the shut up manifests in meditation as as going into a dull state or falling asleep. So agitation where the mind just, you know, rushes around like a crazy monkey, not just an ordinary monkey, but a crazy monkey, you know, that becomes very clear, and often that's a sign of leading a very imbalanced life, and one which is giving your brain too much to do, and the brain is just squealing, you know, just, I can't handle this, it's too much, and it's just running around. But there's also another aspect of this, and this is the worry mind and the guilty mind, and the mind is just going over and over and over and over again about mistakes we've made and things we've done that we shouldn't have done, and things we shouldn't have done that we do. And talking about like cultural differences again, when I go home, I usually won't sit with all my family. You know, always mostly movie buffs. So I sit and they sort of choose a movie that's appropriate for a monk to watch, or is it something, you know, it's like not. And so it's like a family thing, and so I always feel like an anthropologist when I watch like movies, because things that I notice are not the same things other people. So I found that you know, when someone writing a movie script, when they want to tell the viewer that this is a good person, one of the very simplest and shorthand ways they do this is that they have the hero or the heroine feel bad about something that went wrong, even though it wasn't their fault. So, you know, somebody's just like agonizing over the death of something or some bad thing happened, and somebody says, well, it wasn't your fault, you didn't intend to do that, which is a very Buddhist reflection, you see. And I think, well, that's really smart, yes, given. And then the person just sort of shrugs it off, you know, but no, I'm a noble. He doesn't actually say this, but you know, I'm the hero. I've got to feel bad about these things. So I really, this kind of fetishization of guilt, you know, and feeling guilty about things means you're a good person. And in Buddhism, this is not the case. Dwelling and indulging in feelings of guilt is considered stupid, basically, and self-destructive. And I think the idea often is, if something unpleasant or unfortunate occurs, then often people want to punish themselves, and they feel that that if you don't feel bad about something that you had some part to play in, then you're getting away for free, and that you deserve to be punished. So people just hold on to things because they feel that they're being noble and that they're punishing themselves for something bad that they did, and going round and round and round and round in their heads. So I don't think this is a good idea. Neither did the Buddha. Not allowing the mind just to just go round and round in circles about things that occurred in the past. So the sense of shame and the sense of guilt are two different things. Shame is a virtue. Guilt is a defilement. And the difference being, shame is a recognition of an action as being foolish or mistaken or wrong or bad. And guilt is the perception, I am a bad person. So shame is not revolving around the sense of self and feeding the sense of self. It's a recognition something was owning up, being honest and saying, yeah, that was wrong, that was foolish, and I've got to do my best to prevent that happening again in the future. But guilt is, I did a bad thing, I shouldn't have done a bad thing, I should have been a better person than I was, I should have been wiser and kinder and so many things I should have been and I wasn't, and it's so bad and I can't do anything about it now, and I'm burdened with this for the rest of my life and it's so miserable. Yeah. So that's the kind of destructive thinking that can arise and be illuminated by meditation. The last one is skeptical doubt, which doesn't mean doubt is all right. Doubt's a good thing, you know. If you don't, if you recognize that there are things that you don't know that you need to know, you doubt about it, and you find out. That's nothing wrong with that at all. But if you need to have some cast iron guarantees before you do anything, I have to know 100% that this is right for me before I'm going to put effort into it, I'm going to risk myself, or I'm going to expose myself in any way. I need to know beforehand, is this, or maybe something else. That kind of crippling kind of doubt is a hindrance to meditation and practice, and again something that is exposed by practice. So in summary, what the main point I've been trying to make in this talk is that when we meditate, there are problems, there are defilements, there are desires and aversions and sleepiness and dullness and agitation, and that doesn't mean that you're not doing it right. Or there's something wrong with you, or you should be better than this, or you should be able to deal with this. But the meditation is designed to produce this effect, because it's only through studying and learning and seeing these things that we develop the ability to protect our mind against them and to let go of them and to cultivate the antidotes to them. So don't get this idea of a good meditation or a bad meditation, and a good meditation means you don't have any problems. It's nice, obviously, it's preferable. But in terms of the work, which will have long-lasting effects and be of great value to you in your life, then a lot of that best work is done where you have challenges, where you're there's agitation in the mind, there's dullness, there are sensual desires, there are aversions. And dealing with these things is one of the key advantages and benefits of this practice of meditation. So this is the evening talk I'd like to offer you this evening.